Welcome to Voter Information, the show that looks at elections in the city, the state, and the nation. I'm your election guru, Mark Braun here. Glad you could join us today. And I remind you, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read in AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. No siree. All right, so we're going to do some miscellaneous things this week. And so we're going to start off first with, yeah, you guessed it, an obituary. This is from the obituary section of the Los Angeles, California section of the Los Angeles Times, Thursday, February 27, 2025. Roger John Diamond, environmental attorney, advocate for underdogs. His 55-year career includes criminal law. The Pacific Palisades resident was 81. By Hannah Fry. Whether addressing a jury in court or chatting at the dinner table with his family, Roger John Diamond had a flair for the dramatic. Once while representing an adult entertainment venue, he sprang to his tiptoes in a Los Angeles County courtroom and twirled on one foot with his arms above his head in his suit and tie. "What is dancing?" he asked jurors as he pranced and paraded across the room. "Is this dancing to you?" Some will say yes and others will say no, and who's right? He said, according to a Times article from the Time, it's essentially an art form, and that's what these new dancers are doing. They're not immoral people. I truly believe that they're engaging in an art form. Diamond prevailed in that case, as he did in many others over a 55-year career spanning a variety of legal areas, including criminal defense. His crusades against cities that attempted to force out sex-oriented businesses earned him headlines as one of Southern California's leading defenders of venues that some considered obscene. Although Diamond himself didn't have interest in the adult bookstores or shops he represented, he saw attempts to stifle them as trampling on hard-won First Amendment rights. But even though his commitment to his beliefs drew him attention and admiration in his professional life, it was his dedication to his wife, daughters, and four grandchildren that left a lasting impression of those who knew him. Diamond died February 20 at the rental property where he was living with his family after losing his home in the Pacific Palisades fire. Diamond, 81, had been diagnosed with an inoperable sarcoma, a rare type of cancer, according to his family. "He was a character," his daughter Laura Diamond told the Times. "As much as he was a really brilliant and unique maverick kind of lawyer, he was such a family man, playful, silly, loving." A Los Angeles native, Diamond graduated from Hamilton High School before attending UCLA for his bachelor's degree and law school. He wed his high school sweetheart, Fran, assuaging his parents' concerns about the prospect of marrying at such a young age by saying it really was possible to score the winning ticket on the first try. He never drank alcohol or smoked. He found the latter habit so offensive that he at times deployed a squirt gun on the lighted cigarettes of unsuspecting smokers. He was passionate about sports and for decades organized a weekly touch football game with rotating team members. He loved Lady Gaga and believed that sunscreen just wasn't effective if you rubbed it in, regardless of how silly it may have looked, according to his eldest granddaughter, Rebecca Diamond. "He was goofy, wonderfully eccentric, and one of a kind," she wrote in her eulogy. "He was not merely my grandfather. He was my best friend. Nothing brought me greater joy than making him laugh. He had the best laugh and the silliest dance move." Diamond was a champion for the underdog, a trait he emphasized for his two daughters as they were growing up, Laura Diamond said, and when he found something to be unfair, either societally or personally, he didn't sit back and complain. He sprang into action. After graduating from law school in 1966, Diamond bought himself season tickets to the Los Angeles Rams. When the Rams and Raiders both announced plans to leave Los Angeles, he sued for breach of contract, alleging that the personal seat licenses granted to seat ticket holders gave them the ability to renew annually. The agreement they settled on was that Diamond could renew his season tickets in St. Louis, where the Rams moved, and Oakland, then home to the Raiders. He toured the stadium so he could choose the best seat, which in his mind was definitely the 50-yard line, but didn't want to be too low because then you didn't have perspective over the entire field, Laura Diamond said. For the next two seasons, he mailed Laura, then a law student at UC Berkeley, a ticket for each Raiders home game, fly to Oakland for a day, and meet her at their seats. Roger Diamond made a career out of challenging authority and championing lost causes, sometimes changing the law in the process. Shortly after the family moved to the Pacific Palisades in the late 1960s, Diamond quit his job at a large law firm to file a class action suit against hundreds of smoke-producing companies in Los Angeles County to hold them responsible for the dirty air that enveloped the region. Many of those companies were clients of his former firm. Diamond didn't have money for a postage, so he walked into office buildings in downtown Los Angeles, looked through directories for the defendants, and served them at their desks personally, his family said. Although that small case wasn't successful, Diamond remained a committed environmentalist. He helped lead the 20-year fight against Occidental Petroleum Corp., which sought to drill in the Palisades. He ran unsuccessfully for California Assembly of 1970 and 72 with the campaign slogan, "If you breathe, vote for Diamond." In 1976, he ran for Los Angeles City Attorney with the goal of suing tobacco companies and banning cigarette smoking indoors. Although he wasn't elected, he didn't give up on those ideas. He helped get California's first proposition to ban indoor smoking on the ballot in the late 1970s. His foray into politics also led him to believe that the practice of listing incumbents first on the ballot gave them an unfair advantage, so he sued to change it. The result? California now uses a lottery to decide placement of candidate names. He had a clear vision that he had confidence in, and he just followed it, Laura Diamond said. He knew in his heart if something was wrong or right or wrong. He talked about the law with reverence, and it was a tool to change culture. That was Roger John Diamond, environmental attorney, advocate for underdogs, by Hannah Fry, from the California section of the Los Angeles Times for Thursday, February 27, 2025. Okay, on to this one from the city and state section of the Los Angeles Times, Friday, January 3rd, 2025. 2026 races are heating up in Latino-heavy OC districts. Several Democrats have announced bids for state Senate and Assembly seats, by Gabriel San Roman. A few days after the Orange County Registrar of Voters certified the November elections last month, a flurry of Democratic politicians were already turning their attention toward 2026 races. The state Senate and Assembly contests that are quickly heating up are centered in Anaheim and Santa Ana, where the electorate is largely Latino and Democrat. Because of that, whoever leads the June 2, 2026 statewide primary election is largely seen as the victor come that November, since Republican candidates are not expected to be competitive. What's going to be determined in these races is what Latino politics will look like in the course of the next decade, said Mike Madrid, author of The Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy, and a senior fellow at UC Irvine School of Social Ecology. The centrist Democrat model is one that's been around since Representative Lou Correa won seats in the Assembly and Senate during the 90s. The new model is more left-leaning. In looking to continue his meteoric ascent in electoral politics, Democratic Assemblyman Avelino Valencia announced his candidacy for the 34th Senate District, a seat currently held by State Senator Tom Umberg, who will be termed out of office in 2026. Valencia commented on his reasons for running, which includes a desire to improve schools and build houses. Serving in the state Senate will give me an opportunity to make an even bigger impact on our Orange County communities, Valencia said. This Senate district shouldn't be viewed as a consolation prize or a stepping stone. One district is home to nearly 1 million Orange County residents, and we deserve to have a responsive, committed, and effective advocate. Valencia bested Bomero Boomer Vicente, a progressive Democrat, during a primary election in 2022 on his way to winning the 68th Assembly District. As an incumbent, he handily won re-election in November 2024. Through legislation, he has gained a reputation as a good government reformer, which has softened the edge of some of his most ardent progressive critics. Valencia, who previously served on the Anaheim City Council, pushed for a state audit of Visit Anaheim, the city's tourism bureau, after allegations of a grafting scheme were detailed in an independent corruption report he voted to commission as a councilman. Prompted by the Andrew Doe scandal, he also backed legislation requiring a majority vote from the Orange County Board of Supervisors before any discretionary funds are allocated to a nonprofit or community group. He also championed legislation that disallows campaign funds to be used for legal defense if a politician is convicted of certain felony crimes. Fresh off his narrow defeat to Republican Steve Choi in the 37th Senate District, former State Senator Josh Newman is eyeing a return to Sacramento through the 34th Senate District. He is proud of his existing record, including revamping textile recycling programs, chairing the Senate Committee on Education, and securing funds for groups such as Access California Services, which is based in Anaheim. There are still plenty of outstanding issues in Newman's estimation. California is facing some substantial challenges around housing affordability, access to care, and access to higher education, Newman said. There is important work to be done, including transitioning to clear energy sources in the face of climate change. In order to run for the district, which is centered in Anaheim but stretches from South Whittier to Santa Ana, Newman would have to move, which already has triggered criticisms from those who see him as opposing Valencia as the Anaheim Rays' homegrown candidate. Newman reminds voters that he has represented the areas of Anaheim before, when the former 29th Senate District overlapped with the current drawn boundaries of the 34th Senate District. "I've represented that area longer than anybody who was in the legislature right now," he said. Valencia's state Senate candidacy opened up another race for his 68th Assembly District seat that already is heating up and could prove to be more of a pitched battle over the future of OC Latino politics. "There is overwhelming evidence that there is a Latino shift towards more populist politics," Madrid said. "The question is which strain of populism will be a definitive feature for Latino politics. Orange County may be the first place we start to really see it in a way where it's going to be contestable. Santa Ana Councilman David Peñaloza has announced his campaign for Valencia's assembly seat. He already counts the backing of Valencia Assembly Speaker Robert Rivas and Santa Ana Mayor Valerie Amezcua. This campaign has started off with an economically focused message. "We've seen how many Californians are fleeing the state for economic reasons," Peñaloza said. "The quality of life has also declined in the last 10 years. A sense of safety is just not there. That's broken for many working families in the state." In the last 6 years on the Santa Ana City Council, Peñaloza has taken a moderate position on issues concerning development, police, homelessness, and crime in the city. "My focus has been how we can make we at the same time make life less expensive for residents in Santa Ana, but also safe," he said. "I'm a big proponent of parks and libraries. At the same time, people are upset that we are opening up these new amenities because of safety concerns. It's a revolving circle of issues that our community has to deal with." Peñaloza may face off with his Santa Ana City Council colleague Jesse Lopez, who is said to be a potential candidate in the race. When reached by phone, Lopez said she is taking a strong look at the Assembly District but hasn't announced any run. As a councilwoman, Lopez has a record of backing progressive policies geared towards Santa Ana's working-class residents, including rent control, eviction protection, and supporting direct economic assistance to residents during the pandemic. Lopez beat a recall election last year in which she was outspent 8-1 by her opponents. She also won re-election to Santa Ana City Council in November, edging out a victory in Ward 3, the city's most moderate electorate. That was 2026 races are heating up in Latino-heavy OC districts by Gabriel San Roman From the City and State section of the Los Angeles Times, Friday, January 3rd, 2025. All right, here's something from the perspective section of the Los Angeles Times for Sunday, February 9, 2025. Bay Area Tremor, Democratic Moderation, by Mark C. Baraback, reporting from Sacramento. These are soul-searching days for Democrats, a time of reckoning and self-criticism as they try to comprehend why they lost Congress and the White House and struggling to find their way back from political purgatory. The examination extends even so far as San Francisco, a place famed for its liberalism and smugness, where the inward-looking reflection began even before Trump's restoration to the White House. In 2022, voters cast out three uber-progressive members of the school board who seemed more intent on symbolic gestures such as renaming public schools to erase the likes of Abraham Lincoln and Paul Revere than student achievement. A few months later, the district attorney, Chesa Bowden, was recalled in response to his perceived bleeding-heart approach to public safety. Continuing apace, voters in November elected a political newcomer and relative moderate, Dan Lurie, as mayor and punctuated the sentiment by gifting him a more simpatico board of supervisors at San Francisco's Baruch City Hall. In the same vein, the city's Democratic Party, not exactly a pro-MAGA choir, has moved closer to the middle, electing a leader who sees Trump's election and improved standing in this blue bastion as one of those moments when red lights flash and sirens blare. One of the issues with the Democratic Party right now is that so much of party politics, especially at the local level, has been largely performative and not really relevant to the everyday lives of the working people, said the local party chair, Nancy Tung, and I think we're seeing the backlash now nationally. San Francisco is not about to turn into a hillier version of Kansas or become Alabama with views of the Pacific. Trump received 6,000 votes more here in November than he did 4 years ago and boosted his support by 2.5%. Still, he lost to Kamala Harris, the city's former district attorney, by nearly 65 percentage points. Tung's politics should also be put in some perspective. She checks all the Democratic boxes, pro-choice, anti-Trump, and on laughingly jokes that in many places she'd be called a communist. But Tung is a centrist by San Francisco standards, and the city's political pendulum, which has long oscillated between left and far left, has clearly swung her direction. "People can call me whatever they want," she said over lunch in the city's Mission District. "I think government should work for people, and at the local level, there's some really basic things that should not be controversial, right? Every community deserves good public schools. They deserve safe streets, clean sidewalks. Government that works, that's not overly bureaucratic, that's not putting giant special interests ahead of everyday people." Tung, 50, is the daughter of Taiwanese immigrants. She grew up in Southern California, in Arcadia, before moving to the Bay Area, where she has spent most of her career as a prosecutor. Her work in the San Francisco DA's office focuses on hate crimes. Tung began her political activism fairly recently, after Trump's upset victory in 2016. On a trip to Washington, she had planned to celebrate Hillary Clinton's historic election as America's first female president. Instead, she had an ugly cry at the National Portrait Gallery, seated before a rendering of women who've served on the Supreme Court. A few weeks later, Tung was back at the Capitol, marching on the eve of Trump's first inauguration with bullhorn in hand. At home, she redoubled her political engagement by signing up with one of San Francisco's myriad Democratic clubs. Eventually, though, Tung grew estranged, feeling marginalized not because she was a woman or Asian American, but because other Democrats wouldn't accept her comparative moderation. In 2019, she ran unsuccessfully for district attorney, losing to Bowden. The next year, the Board of Supervisors scuttled Tung's nomination to the police commission because, in the climate following George Floyd's murder, she was seen as too pro-police. Slowly, however, the political winds shifted, as they often do. By 2022, it was the leadership of the San Francisco Democratic Party that seemed out of step. Among other moves, the party opposed the school board recalls, which 70% of voters supported, and the ouster of Bowden, who was handily turned out of office. In 2024, Tung led a centrist slate that took control of the party. Over lunch at a favorite Indian-Pakistani restaurant, she described her goals between now and the end of her term in April 2028. Tung's demeanor, as one might expect of a prosecutor, was no-nonsense, arms crossed, brow creased. The most important thing, Tung suggested, was moving away from abstractions and indulgences that addressing issues that touch voters' daily lives. Tung cited a resolution the local party passed some years ago opposing the use of child labor in Africa's chocolate trade. A terrible thing, yes, but why, she wondered, were Democrats in San Francisco devoting time to the matter? It makes people think you're out of touch, Tung said. Why is there something about child labor in another country and not something about how we're treating children here? That may be reductive, but the point is well taken. If the last election showed anything, it's that high-minded principles like standing up for democratic norms are less important to many voters than, say, the cost of gasoline and groceries. Democrats, Tung said, forking a serving of rice and lentils, need to actually show people our value, like what we're doing in the community. Are you helping feed people? Are you helping clothe people? Are you helping connect people to services? Are you helping people cut through red tape at City Hall? Inevitably, the conversation turned to Trump and fears the country is goose-stepping its way to dictatorship. Yes, Tung said, party leaders like yourself can and should speak out and help channel democratic outrage. There's information and resources to share with individuals and groups such as immigrants who may be targeted by punitive policies. Can we provide support to people who care, who are impacted? Yes, we can, Tung said. Can we provide a forum for people who want to speak out? Yes, you can do that too. But the real resistance, Tung said, will have to come from elected officials, from members of Congress, from attorneys general, and others fighting the Trump administration in court. She didn't say it, but the reality is, if Democrats really hope to stop Trump's excesses and his bulldozing of federal programs, they'll have to take back some measure of power in Washington. And there's a great deal of work to be done. Bay Area Tremor, Democratic Moderation, by Mark C. Baraback, reporting from San Francisco. Out of the Perspective section of the Los Angeles Times, Sunday, February 9, 2025. All right, this is from the Opinion Voices section of the Los Angeles Times for Tuesday, March 4, 2025. Why California Latinos are as divided as everyone else. Voters elected a record number of Latino Republicans to the legislature, underscoring the community's political complexity, by Mike Madrid, guest contributor. In 1998, four Latino Republicans were elected to the California legislature. As the press secretary for a Republican legislative leader, I convened a news conference demanding an end to a discriminatory policy. The all-Democratic Latino Legislative Caucus should stop insisting on a political monoculture and allow Republicans to join. 25 years later, California's Latino Legislative Caucus still excludes Republicans. In contrast to states such as Arizona and Texas, whose Latino caucuses are bipartisan, California's Latino Republicans remain excluded from an ethnic caucus that purports to represent them. This particularly mirrors the history of Latino political empowerment in the state. When the caucus was founded in 1973 by the late LA Assemblymember Richard Alatorre and others, it seemed inconceivable that any consequential number of Latino Republicans could be elected to serve in Sacramento. That proved accurate for decades. But now, as the rightward shift of Latino voters has swept a record number of Republican Latino lawmakers into the Capitol, there are now 9 who have formed their own caucus. The debate has been resurrected. This time, it feels different because Latino voters and identity are different. Today's Latinos lack the defined ethnic and racial perspective of the prior generations. New Latino voters are overwhelmingly U.S.-born, primarily English-speaking, and more likely to see themselves as typically American than to associate with their countries of origin. And they are more likely than members of any other ethnic group to be unaffiliated with a political party. Latinos are becoming more populist and less partisan. Over the years, since I was a bright-eyed 20-something staffer, I've come to doubt the practicality of a bipartisan Latino caucus, which now seems like a lost opportunity of the last generation. A bipartisan California Latino caucus could have focused on shared goals such as improving public education, increasing college attendance and graduation rates, making housing more affordable, and preserving the upward mobility of working-class Californians, all of which should have been Sacramento's priority too. Instead, by nearly every social and economic metric, Latinos are worse off now than they were a generation ago, despite their exponential growth of Latino representation. This failure unfolded in a time of increasingly blistering partisanship. Today, a bipartisan caucus is no more likely to achieve a broad productive consensus than our bipartisan legislature. A truly representative Latino caucus seems incompatible with both major parties. Each party certainly has a legitimate claim to representing aspects of the Latino community. Democrats are much more in line with Latinos in immigration reform, healthcare access, and reproductive rights, despite what you may have heard about Latinos' cultural conservatism. Republicans are much more in line with Latinos on border security, crime, and building and housing and economic opportunities. But the evidence that neither party has a hold on the hearts and minds of Latino voters is overwhelming. Democrats have no more claim to Latino identity than Republicans, and the idea that putting partisans from both camps under the same ethnic tent might bring about commonality on hot-button issues such as reproductive rights or mass deportations is nonsense. Why? Because Latino politicians on both sides are far more interested in their partisan identity than they are in advocating for the priorities of the Latino community they claim to represent. Otherwise, Latino Democratic politicians would be greater advocates for tough-on-crime measures as the recently passed Proposition 36, which Latino voters supported overwhelmingly. They would be much fiercer proponents for overturning extreme environmental and regulatory measures, such as the California Environmental Quality Act, which has helped turn housing affordability into a generational crisis for the state's Latinos, among others. And they would be doing a better job of holding the state's Democratic-dominated government accountable for failing Latinos on a spectrum of issues. Republican Latino politicians, meanwhile, would have the courage to openly denounce President Trump's overt appeals to racism. They would also be more supportive of reproductive rights, investments in healthcare, and a pathway to citizenship for the millions of immigrants our economy desperately needs. But expecting Latino politicians to put their communities ahead of their parties appears to be asking too much these days. Latino politicians, ironically, have matured to the point of being like other politicians, more focused on power and partisanship than on solving the problems of a community that has been clear about its priorities for decades. Perhaps an ethnic caucus can't effectively serve California's largest ethnic group because the whole idea suggests Latinos are the sort of woefully underrepresented minority we no longer are. At the same time, Latino voters are more moderate, independent, and focused on day-to-day economic issues than any other ethnic group in the state. California and the country need politicians to be more like them. As our society is becoming more diverse, Californians are becoming less interested in our racial and ethnic differences than in their common economic struggles. Pocketbook issues are replacing identity issues. If Latino lawmakers were as preoccupied with those issues as Latino voters have been for many years, they would be working across the aisle to address them with no need for a caucus, bipartisan or otherwise. The two parties' incessant need to fight about cultural issues has come at the expense of focusing on economic mobility. We don't need a bipartisan Latino caucus to get things done. We need a bipartisan legislature solving economic problems that disproportionately affects Latinos. That's the great opportunity for the emerging generation of Latino lawmakers to assume leadership in both parties and make the entire legislature work better. Latino politicians on both sides of the aisle need to start leading the parties instead of following them. That was Why California Latinos Are as Divided as Everyone Else by Mike Madrid, guest contributor, from the Opinion Voices section of the Los Angeles Times, Tuesday, March 4, 2025. Mike Madrid is a political consultant and the author of The Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Changing Democracy. All right, so now let's go on to an article regarding the special mayoral race in Oakland. And this is from a publication called CaliforniaGlobe.com. And this is called Oakland Mayoral Special Election Candidate List Set. Former Congresswoman Barbara Lee is the favorite among 15 declared candidates by Evan Simon, January 22, 2025. The candidate list for the 2025 Oakland mayoral special election was finalized this week with 15 candidates in total, including former Congresswoman Barbara Lee and former City Councilman Lauren Taylor, currently set for an April special election. Following the recall of Mayor Sheng Tao in November, mayoral candidates for the April special election trickled in. Taylor, who lost to Tao in 2022, was one of the first to declare following Tao's recall and was an early leader in terms of support thanks to carryover from the 2022 election. Other early candidates included economist Minnie Pechinuk, lobbyist Isaac Koss Reed, and fellow 2022 candidate Derek Sue. While the list only comprised of a handful of names going into 2025, the race received a boost in media attention when Lee declared on January 13 that she was running. Lee, who came in a disappointing fourth place in the U.S. Senate primary in March 2024 and recently just left her congressional seat, became the new favorite in the race overnight. As a congresswoman for Oakland for decades, Lee already has a huge base of support in Oakland, as well as a staff already there to help build up a campaign. Throughout last week, many potential candidates declined to run because of Lee entering the race, including Councilwoman Carol Fife. Others like interim Mayor Kevin Jenkins and former NFL star and Governor Gavin Newsom's podcast co-host Marshawn Lynch also wound up not filing. However, close to a dozen other candidates did wind up putting their names in by the January 17 filing due date. Amongst the most notable names were controversial Olympic skier Elizabeth Swanee, former chief of staff to then-Mayor Tao Reyna Webb, and former member of the Oakland Library Advisory Commission, and 2022 mayoral election candidate Tyrone Jordan. After several days of checking paperwork, election officials have kept all the submitted candidates. However, the list could be smaller by the time ballots are printed, as some dropouts of the race are expected. Several current candidates have said that they might drop out thanks to Lee entering the race. Nonetheless, as of Wednesday, there are 15 currently listed candidates for mayor. Pollsters told The Globe Wednesday that the race is currently Lee's to lose, with early indications showing a relatively easy path to victory for Lee. As the special election on April 15th is to have ranked choice voting, Lee is expected to be the number one candidate for many voters. Everyone in Oakland is familiar with Lee, Alameda County pollster Nathan Martin told The Globe Wednesday. She's running at age 78, so age might be a factor to some. Also, she's very much to the left, so conservative and moderate voters are going to have a problem voting for her. But beyond that, Lee has the support of the majority of voters. She was their congresswoman for 27 years, so she has that base. And finally, she doesn't want to end her political career on a huge loss, with mayor of Oakland being her lead-out position in all likelihood. Beyond Lee, the next best shot is Taylor. He lost a very close race to Tao in 2022, and has still not gotten over that. He's also popular in the city thanks to his time as a city councilman. If there's anyone who could beat Lee, it's him. hot topics in the next 3 months we are going to be seeing in ads, in speeches, and at debates are going to be public safety, Oakland's economic decline, funding the police and other departments, Oakland's budget crisis, homelessness, drugs, and Lee's age. And out of all those, the biggest will be public safety. Crime seems to be everywhere, and people are afraid to go to many parts of the city. Candidates will need to convince voters that they can do all they can before the next mayoral election in November 2026. That's a little more than a year and a half to make an impact. These debates, if nothing else, will be interesting. That was Oakland Mayoral Special Election Candidate List Set by Evan Simon from CaliforniaGlobe.com for January 22nd, 2025. Evan V. Simon is the senior editor for the California Globe. Prior to the Globe, he reported for the Pasadena Independent, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and was head of the Personal Experiences section at Cracked. He can be reached at evan@CaliforniaGlobe.com. All right, let's bring you the list of that of those mayoral candidates. And starting, these are the declared candidates. It's we got Wendy Adams, then John Gatlin, a job training professional, President Christina Grappo, a candidate for U.S. Senate in 2016, Desmond Jeffries, Director of Recruitment and Retention for the Alameda County District Attorney's Office, Tyrone Jordan, a former member of the Oakland Library Advisory Commission and candidate for mayor in 2022. Barbara Lee, former U.S. Representative from California's 12th Congressional District and candidate for U.S. Senate in 2024. Peter Liu, entrepreneur and perennial candidate. Mindy Pichinuk, economist and a LaRoucheite. Fabian Robinson, a pastor. Eric Markham Simpson. Andrea Smith, Elizabeth Swanee, competitive skier and candidate for governor in 2003, Lauren Taylor, a former city councilor for the 6th District and runner-up for mayor in 2022, Renia Webb, former chief of staff for then-mayor Sheng Tao, and Larry Young Jr., a real estate broker and candidate for mayor in 2010. Among the declined candidates are Kevin Jenkins, the interim mayor, and Janani Ramachandran, a city councilor for the 4th District. And see, we have for endorsements here for Barbara Lee on the federal level, Latifah Simon, a U.S. representative from California's 12th District, former Governor Jerry Brown, statewide official. For state legislature, she's also got Mia Bonta and Buffy Wicks, both members of the state assembly. And municipal officials are three former mayors, Elihu Harris, Gene Kwan, and Libby Schaff. Nobody else has posted any endorsements as of right now. And let's go to Redondo Beach, where they just recently had their mayoral election. This is from the dailybreeze.com. Redondo Beach election, here's where the mayoral race stands as of Tuesday, by Tyler Shauna Evans for March 5th, 2025. Redondo Beach voters have chosen their next mayor, but it's not yet known who that is. City Clerk's office announced preliminary results around 8:30 p.m. Tuesday, March 4th, in Redondo Beach's all-mail-in election. The city, for the first time, is using the ranked choice method unless a given candidate receives a majority of first-place votes. The unofficial results released Tuesday included about 4,500 ballots that arrived before Election Day, and only voters' first-choice rankings were counted. Ballots that came in after that will be tabulated on March 13, when the final votes will be announced. None of the candidates had a majority of the votes as of Tuesday, but appointed Mayor Jim Light was closest with 1,816 votes, accounting for about 43.6% of the total. And second was outgoing District 1 Councilmember Niles Narenheim, who had 1,190 votes, or 28.6%. Business owner Joan Irvine, who had 459 votes, or 11%, former councilmember and business owner Jeff Ginsburg had 358 votes, or 8.6%, and former city commissioner and art producer Georgette Gantner had 339 votes, or 8.1%. It's really exciting to see the slow growth. Bill Brand Legacy leading the charge, Narenheim said, of he and Light so far garnering the most votes. It's still really up in the air. We'll find out next week. Folks, that'll do it for this edition of Voter Information. And so, until next time, everybody, this is your election guru, Mark Braun. Happy voting and peace.